And our last case this morning is Jones versus Cummings. Mr. Avery.
Yes.
You may proceed. There you are.
Yes. Sir, Your Honor, are we live?
Yeah, we're ready for you whenever you're ready. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is James Avery, and I represent the appellant, Mr. David Jones. In this case, Mr. Jones was denied the ability to proceed with a claim of malicious prosecutorial misconduct, following, of course, Seventh Circuit and Supreme Court precedent. And this case, however, does present an unusual fact pattern that has not been either before this court or before the Supreme Court in the context of whether to grant absolute immunity to the prosecutors.
So, Mr. Avery, I can't resist asking you right off the bat, by what authority do you think this court can disregard Imbler against Pacman from the Supreme Court, can disregard Stump against Sparkman? I mean, where do we get the authority to say, well, the facts here are different, and so we're going to limit absolute judicial or prosecutorial immunity in a way the Supreme Court's never done?
Well, Your Honor, the Supreme Court, because it's never faced a case precisely like this, has not commented directly. There, of course, is a lot of language. There's language in Imbler that's very broad in scope.
Well, that's what the we're point. The court was trying, at least as I read it, the court was saying this, like judicial immunity, its cousin, this is a longstanding and broad immunity for prosecutors. And we understand it comes at a certain cost, but that's a cost we think, you know, is built into the existence of the doctrine. And I just am not sure why you think we're free to say to the Supreme Court, well, we've decided not to follow this.
I'm not asking you not to follow it. I'm asking you, Your Honor, and I believe you have the authority to circumscribe the rule. The rule, of course, was, you know, 60 years ago. There's been many cases which have circumscribed the rule. There's many cases that, for example, involve the pretrial conduct, investigatory activities, other things that are not considered within the advocacy role of the prosecutor. I think this is another case which really involves pretrial conduct that is not the advocacy role of the prosecutor. This case, if you circumscribe the rule, follows more closely to the pattern of cases where the prosecutors are not engaged in what would be considered the trial process.
Why isn't filing charges the most core function of a prosecutor there is? They weren't out there scouring the streets to find who did it, you know, so to speak. They're making a decision, which is, in our system, completely up to the prosecutor. Prosecutorial discretion is very important. What charges to file? Now, the fact that this prosecutor and actually the deputies may have made a mistake about when you could file it under state law says nothing about immunity.
Your Honor, if I beg to correct you, the case involves a malicious decision to prosecute someone specifically to add charges that added decades to his sentence, and he in fact served more than 10 years as a result of this malicious conduct.
So it you would recognize immunity only where there's some good faith reason to believe that the charges are going to hold? That would be a very limited version.
in a malicious prosecution case, I do believe that the immunity should only be qualified. I believe that the fact that this conduct was flagrantly illegal, and remember, this court allowed Mr. Jones to be freed
on the basis of ineffective assistance of counsel, not on the basis of what any of the prosecutors did or the judge or anything. The Jones against the Techie case is based on counsel.
It's a habeas corpus proceeding. It's two sides of the same coin. The prosecutors were the ones that brought the charges. The public defenders had, of course, been malfeasance, but their negligence is pale in comparison to the malicious conduct of the prosecutors, who said that Mr. Jones is not worthy. He's someone who's not worthy of due process of the courts. This really is offensive, and it should be offensive to the court. It should be a situation, and I believe the rule should be, and of course, and I believe the reform and the circumscription of the Supreme Court rules must happen in the circuit courts, because the district courts have no choice but to follow the precedent. The circuit courts circumscribing this rule can and has every authority and every right and should adopt a rule that when prosecutors are flagrantly violating the law, they are acting outside of the scope of their function as a quasi-judicial officer and should be immune to, and should not be immune to civil liability for that. Civil liability is the only effective deterrent to prosecutorial misconduct. There's many journal articles, many legal scholars.
If I could interject, that's an argument against the absolute nature of absolute immunity, and you'll have to address it to the Supreme Court. We don't have the authority to get around that.
Well,
if this was not prosecutorial conduct, then we have cases that permit the claim to go forward. In other words, if the prosecutors were engaged in investigative conduct. But as Judge Wood pointed out, this is quintessentially prosecutorial conduct. And that means there's absolute immunity, and your argument against the absolute nature of absolute immunity has to be addressed to the Supreme Court, not this court.
Well, Chief Judge, I think you would agree with me that if this was an investigative
Yes, but that's not your claim. Your claim is not that this is investigative conduct. Your claim is that there should not be absolute immunity because this was really, really egregious.
That's
not how absolute immunity works. Absolute immunity is absolute. It covers really egregious conduct if it's performed by a prosecutor in the exercise of a prosecutorial function, and the charging decisions, even if they're erroneous and egregiously so, are quintessentially prosecutorial. That's the end of your case.
Chief Judge, I recognize that the precedent that you're facing is overwhelmingly leading you in that direction. But I believe you do have the authority to circumscribe the rule. I believe that this is pretrial conduct. This is not an advocacy function in front of a judge. It is not an advocacy function in front of a jury.
So, Mr.
We're not talking about, yes.
Can I just interject? I mean, we understand what you're saying, but the law is pretty well established. You would be on more solid ground if you were simply saying, I know this is a step beyond. I'm trying to preserve this argument for Supreme Court consideration so that nobody will say I waived it. And we can certainly confirm that you've preserved it, but we are not the ones who can change it.
Judge Wood, I appreciate your sentiment there. And I just don't agree that you don't have the authority. There's a double negative there. But I believe that this court does have the authority to circumscribe the rule and say that with regard to this pretrial conduct, it is not a function of advocacy. What happened is outside the scope of their role as prosecutors when they pursued illegal charges against this citizen, that this citizen was maliciously deprived of his rights, and therefore qualified immunity is the appropriate standard, not absolute immunity.
All right, thank you. Mr. Kraft?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Aaron Kraft and I represent the prosecutors. This case is easily resolved by several basic Section 1983 principles. First, the official capacity claim fails because Section 1983 cannot be used to expose the state itself to liability. Second, the individual capacity claims fail because absolute immunity attaches to a prosecutor's actions in filing charges or amending charges. And third, even if Mr. Jones could overcome those hurdles, Section 1983 cannot be used to enforce state law. Now, I'd like to begin with the official capacity claim. Indiana prosecutors are arms of the state, not county officials, for two reasons. First, and most importantly, a suit against a prosecutor exposes the state itself to liability, because under Indiana law, the state has a broad obligation to defend and indemnify prosecutors for their official acts. Second, Indiana law has long classified prosecutors as state officials who exercise the sovereign's power in prosecuting crimes committed against the state of Indiana. Now, in these general respects, prosecutors are virtually identically situated to Indiana's trial judges. In this court held nearly 30 years ago in Woods versus Michigan City, the Indiana trial judges are arms of the state, not county officials. It logically follows that so too are prosecutors. And indeed, the district courts in Indiana have long recognized that prosecutors are arms of the state and therefore not amenable to suits for damages in their official capacities under Section 1983. Now, Jones's only argument in response is that he wants discovery to determine if the state has liability insurance. But that argument is misguided for two reasons. First, Indiana law forbids the state from acquiring insurance. But second, even if it didn't, we know from University of California versus Doe that a state's ability to seek indemnification from a third party does not undermine its sovereign immunity or the arm of the state analysis. For these reasons, Jones cannot sue Prosecutor Cummings in his official capacity for damages. Now, with respect to the individual capacity claims, the act of filing charges or filing a motion to amend the charges is clearly a core prosecutorial function. The Supreme Court in Kalina versus Fletcher said as much. So the prosecutors here are entitled to absolute immunity for the filing of the confinement charge against Jones. Moreover, we know from the Vandekamp decision that prosecutorial immunity attaches even to administrative acts that directly bear on prosecutorial functions. So even if Mr. Jones had tried to assert an individual capacity claim against Prosecutor Cummings for adopting a policy on charging, that claim too would be barred by prosecutorial immunity. And as the court, I think, observes, this court has to follow Imbler and Kalina and all the Supreme Court's precedents in this area. Now, lastly, even if Jones could overcome what I think are these two insurmountable hurdles, his claims would still fail because Section 1983 cannot be used to enforce state law or to recover damages for a violation of state law. Jones does not come anywhere close to articulating an actual due process violation. He alleges only that the prosecutors violated state law, but that is not enough. Importantly, although the confinement charge may have been filed 9 days after the omnibus date and therefore been untimely under state law, that charge was filed almost a year before trial. So Jones had ample time to prepare his defense. So that there's no due process violation for the timing of the charge. Moreover, Jones has never alleged that the charge was unsupported by probable cause. So he can't succeed under a Manuel versus City of Joliet theory either. The upshot to all of this is that Jones's claims are barred by several basic principles of Section 1983 law. And unless there are any questions, the prosecutors respectfully ask that this court affirm the district court's judgment. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Avery, you had a little bit of time left if you have anything further to say.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm trying to start my video. 1 second, probably. technical issue here. Is it running?
It's not, but we can hear you.
Okay. And Your Honor, I don't want to be deemed to have waived Mr. Jones's argument against the in the official capacity claim against the defendant. Certainly, again, our argument is that the malicious illegal conduct outside the scope of the prosecutor's legitimate function should not be subject to the blanket approach of absolute immunity that the district court applied in this case. Again, the Supreme Court has evolved the rule of Imbler. It has adopted a functional approach. Considering a functional approach, if someone is engaged in illegal conduct, as they were in this case, it should not be considered to be within their function as an advocate to the court. Prosecutors are not judges. It's been recognized since the common law that they're quasi-judicial, and they're in no different position than, for example, a public defender or other attorneys practicing before the courts. They do not deserve a greater immunity. They do not deserve a blanket absolute immunity that has to do with anything within their role. They deserve a qualified immunity for innocent mistakes and non-malicious and non-illegal conduct.
All right, Mr. Avery, your time has now expired.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
All right. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and that concludes our calendar for today. The court will be in recess.